there, everybody. You are listening to This Show Is So Gay. I'm your host, Ken Schneck. This is episode number 380. As always, you can get in touch with us by dropping us a line. Send an email on over to ken@thisshowisogay.com. Stroll on over to thisshowisogay.com to learn all about the fun things happening with our little gay radio show that could. You can follow us on Twitter. The handle is This Show Is So Gay. And of course, go on over to that Facebook. Type in This Show Is So Gay. Like us, because we sure as heck like you. Well, great news for all of you fans of Dante's Cove. Dante's Cove, the sexy gay supernatural soap opera. Here TV just announced that they are bringing back the popular network soap opera. They are picking up right where the show left off. There's a new cast. It's the same Cove. There's going to be answers to stuff. And they are using crowdsource funding to make it happen. Here to talk all about it is the creator and director, Sam Ervin. Sam is an award-winning film and television director, producer, screenwriter, author, journalist, educator. In the film world, Sam has directed such features as Guilty as Charged, Acting on Impulse, Out There, Fat Rose and Squeaky, and tons more. He has also produced a dozen additional films, including co-executive producing Bill Condon's Academy Award-winning motion picture, Gods and Monsters. It is one of my absolute favorite films of all time. For television, Sam has directed three entire seasons of Dante's Cove, and he directed every episode of our favorite From Here On Out. Sam's first book, Kay Thompson, From Funny Face to Eloise, was honored by Kirkus Reviews and the Theater Library Association Awards as one of the best biographies of the year. If I say more about Sam, we won't actually have time to talk on this week's episode, so let me just say, Sam Ervin, welcome back to This Show Is So Gay.
Wow, that is a hell of an introduction, Ken. Thank you.
I cut out a ton, Sam. We would have no time to chat.
Exactly. Really thrilled to be here to talk about especially Dante's Cove and this great opportunity for us to bring it back. I did the first three seasons in 2005, 6, and 7. And ever since then, we've just been wanting to bring the show back.
Yeah.
And now we have this incredible opportunity, and we're raising money through Kickstarter, which is the crowdsourcing website, which you can go to at kickstarter.com and check out, you know, all the different premiums and levels of pledges that you can do and the various things that you'll get for that. It's pretty exciting. I mean, they're offering all kinds of really cool stuff. I mean, you could end up being in the show. You could attend a casting session. You could name a character. You could have lunch with the cast. You could walk the red carpet. You could even become an executive producer. You can get advanced scripts. It's unbelievable. So I really encourage everybody to go check it out and see what the premiums are at the different levels of donation.
You understand that you just did the entire pitch. We're done for this week's episode now. Everybody, we'll be back next week with another guest. Sam, that was so exciting. We're going to deconstruct a lot of that and really do a deep dive. But if we can, let's take a bit of a step back for our listening audience. Tell our listening audience, Sam, why the medium of film and television to get your voice out there?
I was always a film fan from the earliest possible age. I grew up in a household where my dad owned movie theaters. So when I was growing up, I would go with him to work and watch films over and over and see them for free and hang out in the projection booth. I was like the little kid in Cinema Paradiso. And it was just, you know, a magical way to grow up. And I couldn't get enough of it. And I decided we took a trip to California and toured the studios. And my father got a VIP tour at Warner Brothers, and we walked onto the soundstage where they were shooting The Great Race, the Blake Edwards film.
Yeah.
Natalie Wood and Tony Curtis and Jack Lemmon. And they were doing this amazing scene in a huge tank of water with an iceberg and old antique cars floating on the iceberg. And there was wind and rain and this storm scene. And I was like, wow, that was the big moment of epiphany for an 8-year-old kid. And I was like, I want to do this. And I took my father's 8mm home movie camera out of his hand and never gave it back.
I have to ask, did you ever pay for popcorn in that movie theater?
No, never. I still resent that today when I go to theaters and have to do that. I'm like, this is not what I grew up with.
I see you going to movie theaters and going up to the concession stand and saying, do you not know who my father is? To this day, still doing that.
Exactly.
Oh, it's amazing stuff. Was there a pivotal point where you feel like you decided, well, I'm definitely going to make a go of this?
Well, that was it. I mean, I you know, as soon as I started making little 8mm films when I was a kid and, you know, had my brother play Dracula with a black cape made from a, you know, beach towel and, you know, it was, and ketchup and the whole nine yards. I mean, it was just, it just was in my blood from the earliest age. And then I went to the University of South Carolina and studied film there and was making, you know, short films and stuff. And I ended up running the campus movie theater and decided that I wanted to have a festival of Brian De Palma's early films. And this was before he had done Carrie. And so we booked the films. It was like Phantom of the Paradise and Sisters and those early films that he did. And I managed to get him on the phone. He was in Los Angeles. He lived in New York, but he was in Los Angeles. I tracked him down. He was in a casting session, and they said, he'll be on a break in about 10 minutes, call back. I called back. He gets on the phone, and I present this whole thing and say, you know, would you please come to this festival we're doing in your honor? And he said, hey, I need to get to New York for the weekend. If you'll pay my airfare to South Carolina, then to New York, and then back to L.A., I'll come for the airfare. And I said, done. It turned out the casting session he was in was he and George Lucas were reading Every Kid in Town for Carrie and for Star Wars.
Oh my gosh.
It was this legendary casting session. And but at any rate, he came out. That's when I met him. And then the following summer, between my junior and senior years, I went to Chicago and worked with him as a production assistant and an extra on The Fury that he was directing on location in Chicago with Kirk Douglas and John Cassavetes and a whole huge cast of people. And then after I graduated, he hired me to be the associate producer and production manager of Home Movies, which was a low-budget film that he directed that summer with Kirk Douglas. And then I became his full-time assistant on Dress to Kill and a bunch of other projects for a while until I finally got my own directing career going with Guilty as Charged. It was a film with Rod Steiger and Heather Graham and Lauren Hutton.
You know, at one point in your career, and this is something that I haven't heard you speak too much about, I have a huge appreciation, Sam, for movie posters. And movie posters were a big part of your life at one point.
They are. I mean, I always collected them from the theaters when I was a kid. But then I made a short film called Double Negative that I did it on credit cards, shot it on 35mm, and it actually got selected for Sundance and played theatrically in New York and L.A. But in order to pay for it, I had to get a regular day job. And I started working in film marketing and first worked at United Artists Classics with Tom Bernard and Michael Barker, who went on to create Sony Classics and are still there to this day and are absolutely brilliant. And then a couple of us broke off and formed a company called Spectra Film and released, you know, foreign and art film titles like Paul Verhoeven's The Fourth Man. And so at both of those companies, part of my job was designing the movie posters, and it was just a thing that I absolutely loved. And I ended up winning a couple of Hollywood Reporter Key Art Awards for the posters for Paul Verhoeven's The Fourth Man and Francois Truffaut's Confidentially Yours. And it was, you know, it was really fun to be able to, you know, create things that I hadn't, you know, to actually create posters as opposed to just collecting them.
That's so fun. And by the way, unsolicited recommendation for both Sam and our listening audience, there's a documentary out called 24 by 36, a movie about movie posters, and it is extraordinarily enjoyable. So I encourage people to check that out if you have the opportunity to do so.
I've heard about this, and I'm dying to see it.
Oh, you have to see it. You absolutely have to see it. It's good stuff. It's good stuff. All right. Who is Sam Ervin, the director? If we say, all right, get me Sam, what are they getting? Who are they getting as a director?
Well, I bring a lot to the table in terms of just, you know, having a love of film history. I, you know quite a bit about movies, and I've studied Hitchcock, and I've studied, you know, all the greats. And so I bring a real fanboy sort of element to the table. I'm also incredibly responsible. I bring stuff in on budget and on schedule, and I can do things for really low budgets, which I've been sort of stuck in all these years because I'm the sort of go-to guy for low-budget stuff. And I love those challenges. And so I'm considered a production-friendly director, I guess you'd call it, because they can count on me to deliver it on time and on budget. And that's a really big part of the name of the game. I like all genres, but no matter what genre I'm working in, I like to bring visual style to it. If it's a thriller, you're going to see homages to Hitchcock and De Palma and those kinds of things. And if it's a comedy, you'll see a lot of Blake Edwards because
right.
He had a lot of physical comedy and a lot of slapstick. And, you know, he always had little funny things going on in the background of shots and whatnot. So, I mean, I'm always thinking in terms of the visuals. When I'm trying to direct something, it's difficult on a low budget because you don't always get the time. Sometimes you have to shoot scenes very straightforward with just a master and a close-up and a close-up and move on. But I'm always looking for ways to sort of enhance the visuals.
Now, you've worked with so many celebrities over the year. I've heard tell, it's not my field. I'm over in the radio and education world, and we're certainly not going to name any names on the show, but I've heard tell that perhaps every now and then an actor is difficult. How does Sam Ervin navigate a difficult actor?
A difficult actor? Impossible. There's no such thing. Well, I've run into a couple in my day, and you just have to navigate it. You know, it's that's one of the other jobs that a director has to do, is to figure out how you're going to navigate the various personalities that you come up against, and are those personalities are going to work well with each other. You know, some actors don't get along with each other, and you have to make that chemistry work when the camera rolls. So it's tricky, but, you know, you just have to manage to get through it. And I guess you have to learn how to be a bit of a psychiatrist to try to navigate and get people to work together and just figure out how you can get from A to B to C and get the day done.
Nice. You're appearing here right the second on this show is So Gay. Does being gay enhance your craft?
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, I've been openly gay my entire career as a director. I didn't come out until I was 25, but all the time that I've been directing, I've been out of the closet and very proudly so. And I don't know how I don't know how it affects what I do, but you know, I guess some of the cliches apply. I mean, I think I'm very sensitive to the arts. I'm very I'm always very aware of any kind of discriminatory or sexist or anything. You know, we as gay people have been you know, put upon, and we know what it's like to be discriminated against. So if I read a character or I read something that feels unintentionally, you know, not very politically correct, or if it's treating women in a bad way, or is treating a minority in a bad way, or whatever, that will jump right off the page at me, and I will want to correct that. And so in some ways, I guess I do come from having been a part of a minority from that perspective a bit. It was interesting when we started Dante's Cove, what really appealed to me about that was that, you know, shows like Queer as Folk had always dealt with political issues,
right,
coming out and all those, you know, AIDS or whatever it was. It seemed like there was a lot of that. And when you think about some of the early gay films in the 80s that were, you know, so many of them were dealing with coming out issues and that sort of thing, and in the throughout the 90s and whatnot, and Dante's Cove took it all so matter of fact, and it was just this great soap opera that was populated with gay characters, and who cares, and you know, that's what appealed to me. I was like, wow, this is so not political, and yet it's incredibly political,
yeah,
on a subliminal basis, because it's actually taking all of this as a matter of fact. And so that was really exciting to be a part of that and to actually make a real soap opera with gay characters. And we didn't have to go around saying, hey, we're gay and, you know, we're proud. We just are gay and move on with it, you know, and it was, you know, gay relationships and gay people having sex, and, you know, it was just, there was just no big deal made of it, and that's what it was really exciting for me, making that show, and that's what we're obviously going to continue to do with this next generation.
Yeah. Again, listeners, we are here with Sam Ervin, award-winning film and television director, producer, screenwriter, so much more. Let's jump right into Dante's Cove. For folks who have never seen Dante's Cove before, give them the pitch. Why should they check this show out?
Well, Dante's Cove is basically, I think of it as a combination between Dark Shadows, the great soap opera that I grew up with in the 60s that dealt with supernatural and vampires and witches and it sort of combined with a gay show like Queer as Folk. It's a lot of gay characters, although there are also some straight characters on it as well, and some bisexual characters. And it deals with witchcraft and warlocks and coven that is based on Treasom, which was our own fictional version of this type of witchcraft that they practice. And there's a whole history and Bible that we're going to be following and revealing more and more in the Next Generation series. And we'll be explaining a lot of the background of that whole witchcraft history. And it's people who live on this island of Dante's Cove. We've never identified where it is in the world, so it's just this very, very sort of glamorous, beautiful tropical island, and that happens to be populated by a lot of gay people.
Yeah.
And so we have a lot of, it's an ensemble piece where there are a lot of different relationships going on. But there's also a lot of scary stuff and a lot of witchcraft and you know, it happens.
It does. It does quite a bit. I've seen quite a few episodes of Dante's Cove. I would imagine that the great umbrella of Here TV is quite an inclusive one, quite an empowering one to work under.
Very much so. I mean, the main, one of the heads of the company, Paul Kolishman, he actually gave me my first break to do my first feature film, Guilty as Charged, way back in early 1990s when he was head of a company called IRS Media. And so I've worked with Paul, and he's out and proud gay man, and it's just been, you know, he's been incredibly supportive of my career over all of these years. And the head of development and the producer of our show for Here TV is David Milburn, who's also been incredibly supportive of my career. And he's also an actor and will be playing a role in Dante's Cove, The Next Generation. He's going to be playing the role of Robert. Now, he also produced From Here On Out, which was the comedy series that I did for Here TV. And he played the Out magazine editor in that show. And so, you know, it's a company where the main people that I mean, one of the other partners in the company is Steve Jarko, who happens to be straight. But the main people that I deal with on these shows are usually Paul and David, and they're, you know, because they're gay, they totally get everything that I want to do with these shows, and they're very, very supportive, and they're very supportive of the whole LGBTQ community. They also, you know, the company owns Out magazine and The Advocate, and so they're very ensconced in the whole community, and it's just a very positive situation to be in when you want to support that community and do shows that are going to be fun for this particular audience.
Dante's Cove, we're going on over a decade since it first premiered. You're not the same person that you were 10, 11 years ago. Does it change your approach to directing this content?
Well, you know, I don't know that I'm so different, but it's amazing. When we started the show, there wasn't anything like Dante's Cove. And suddenly, you know, then there was Twilight and there was True Blood and there was all these other shows that seemed like they were borrowing from us. And it was kind of fun that we were sort of trendsetters in that way. And so now to come back, we're going to have to up our game a bit to sort of, you know, to get ahead of this curve that was where the ball was taken from us. And now we're, you know, it's like we're getting the ball back, and we've got to push the envelope even further. And so that's my job as a director, to get in there and, you know, and make sure that we're cutting edge and not, you know, following a trend.
Yeah. You know, Sam, I've never seen an episode of Dante's Cove where I haven't walked away thinking, I guess I should get to the gym. I don't know that it always makes me feel the best about myself. And I should say, in all seriousness, you know, in the LGBT community where we are so rife with body image issues, how do we skirt the line between providing entertainment and also not making people feel terrible?
Well, you know, the way that I look at this, and it's, you know, it's something that I've thought a lot about, is that, you know, there's just fantasy, and this is what this show is. And we do have a lot of really, really gorgeous people. You know, it's also, it's the scenery. You know, we're shooting in gorgeous locations, gorgeous tropical islands, and everything about the show is definitely promoting the whole beauty thing. There's no question about that. And I don't really feel guilty about that. We may not be representing everyone, but it's a fantasy. And, you know, we're not shooting in ugly locations. We're not shooting, you know, in derelict buildings and stuff like that. We're shooting in really pretty places, and it's populated by pretty people. And we're going to have some really hot sex scenes, and that's what the show is. I mean, it's it definitely is a fantasy, and it's like, you know, a fashion magazine spread or whatever. We definitely are going to be on the, you know, we're going to be on the side of finding the, you know, that physical beauty for sure.
Yeah, because I would argue that there are perhaps some elements in Dante's Cove that couldn't happen in real life, that being, you know, the supernatural piece.
Yes, for sure. I mean, yeah.
Fantasy.
Yeah,
I
don't really believe in witches and warlocks. Yes, that's
okay.
True.
All right, just putting that out there. Now, crowdsource funding is, in the scheme of producing film and television content, relatively new. I would imagine that had crowdsource funding been around, you know, years ago, that it would have changed the industry quite a bit.
Yeah, I mean, this is the most amazing advancement that has happened. I mean, and especially for shows like Dante's Cove that have a cult following, and there isn't a lot of money out there, and the audience, you know, there's so many different cable channels and so many different ways that the audiences have been splintered up that it's very hard for companies to actually, you know, afford to finance all of these shows. And this is a way for the fans to get involved and to, you know, if they want to see more of the show, they can help actually do that. And not only just in terms of pledging money, but actually becoming involved as far as, you know, like I was saying before, they can be in the show, they can be an executive producer of the show, they can truly become involved naming a character. So that's what I'm hoping that fans are going to be very excited about. And we certainly had a really, really intense fan base when the show was airing. I mean, there was fan fiction being written, there were, and this is before, you know, social media really exploded the way it is now. So I'm really anxious to see how many of the original fans of the show will come out and support us, and how many new fans who've caught up with the show over the years will, you know, join us and get this thing back on track, because it just, you know, I just feel like it's a show that needs to get back into production, and we need more seasons.
Can I push you on that a little bit? Tell our listening audience why we need more Dante's Cove.
Well, ever since the three seasons finished, everybody that I've run into who are fans of the show will be like, when is it coming back? When are we going to have more? People really want more of this, and I don't see that many shows, frankly, that are predominantly populated by gay characters anymore.
Yeah.
Gosh, you think a few years ago there was, I mean, even a network show like Will and Grace, and there were, you know, but certainly, you know, Queer as Folk, there were quote unquote gay shows. Looking has already come and gone.
Yep.
You know, what's out there right now that is truly a gay show on television? And this, you know, so I'm thinking, wow, this is a great opportunity, and it's definitely a niche that needs to be filled, and nobody else seems to be doing it. And I don't really understand why that is.
I have to ask, do we care if the actors playing gay are gay?
That's a really good question. I don't think so, as long as they are credibly playing the character. I mean, you know, it's not, I don't think that that's necessarily a requirement. And oddly enough, I have found over the years that psychologically there are some gay actors who are a little more uptight about playing gay characters than the straight actors.
Really? Yeah.
And one of the reasons why is because there's a big fear that if a gay actor only, you know, is playing a gay character and it becomes very popular, then he's going to potentially, or the fear is that he will potentially be typecast and only get hired to play gay characters. And so that's one of the big stumbling blocks. Whereas a straight actor who may have several things on their resume of playing straight characters, this can just be another flavor
right.
that they can play, and it's not necessarily as big a deal. I mean, I think years ago it used to be a bigger deal. I think there was always a fear, and maybe there still is, that a straight actor might worry that he could be typecast as a gay character, but I think gay actors are more worried about that. So it's a really interesting thing. I was one of the producers of a film called The Broken Hearts Club several years ago
that the best.
Greg Berlanti directed. Yeah. And it had an amazing cast of characters, and it was about a group of gay guys living in West Hollywood. We had Dean Cain and a whole bunch of straight actors playing these gay characters. But I remember auditioning lots of gay actors, and they were all, in many, many, many cases, they were very nervous and were asking all the wrong questions, and you could tell how nervous they were about it. And Greg ultimately cast a lot of straight actors to play the gay characters because they seemed to be more into it and more credible. So it's a really odd situation. I mean, I hope that there's going to be more openly gay actors out there who are going to be more comfortable playing these roles, and I think it is getting better as we go along. But I don't think that it necessarily, I don't, you know, when someone walks into an audition, A, I'm not legally even allowed to ask because it's very discriminatory, but it's certainly not a prerequisite, and it's not something, you know, I'm looking for the actor who can play the part the best and who, you know, brings that character to life off the page, and that's what's really important, obviously.
Well, you have between 3 and 4 weeks left of this Kickstarter funding campaign, and we will provide the link for everybody, although it's also very easy. You can just go to Kickstarter.com and type in Dante's and you'll find it, but we'll provide the link directly. What happens next? How does this all work? So it will, of course, get funded, although we all don't take it for granted, everybody. You need to go on there and you need to pledge, you need to get your perks and all of that. So then what happens?
Well, we're hoping to raise $300,000.
Okay.
That would fund 6 episodes at $50,000 a piece. Our actual goal is $50,000 because we're hoping to at least be able to make one episode. But once we've raised that money, then we will, you know, immediately start going into pre-production and start setting dates and get this thing made. I mean, we've got an incredible cast put together. I want to mention, aside from David Milburn, our producer, who's playing Robert, we also have Omar Sharif Jr., who's playing a character named Omar.
Nice.
Because we actually developed it thinking of him. And we have a lot of lesser-known actors that are going to, we hope, will be stars in the making, like we did with the original series. I don't know if you recall, but Stephen Amell from Arrow was discovered on our show.
Yeah, I know it doesn't make for good radio, but I am swooning right now. He is so my guy. It's come on. I'm such an Arrow fan.
Yeah. Well, Stephen was incredible. And he was on the first season. And we also had Boo Boo Stewart, who was one of the ghost kids. And he grew up and became one of the werewolf family on the Twilight movies,
yeah.
And he did an X-Men film, and then Aaron Cummings from Astronauts Wives was in our show. So we have all these incredibly good actors that we have put together to create a whole new generation ensemble that's going to be really exciting, I think.
So much coming. Again, folks, you can go to Kickstarter.com, type in Dante's. It pops right up. I have to tell you, Sam, and I don't mean to reduce your career to one project, but you do know that for a huge portion of the LGBTQ community, they only care about one of your films. And there's only one correct answer here, and I will give you a prize if you get it right. There's a part of the community that's obsessed with one of your films almost more than any other. Do you know which film that is?
Elvira's Haunted Hill.
That is the correct answer, Sam.
Yes, I had the great privilege of directing Cassandra Peterson as Elvira, Mistress of the Dark, in Elvira's Haunted Hills. No pun intended.
Done?
It was a dream project, absolutely, for sure.
Okay. I'm just saying, when that season two of Elvira's Haunted Hills comes out, we're all ready.
Yeah. I would love nothing more than to do another Elvira film, let me tell you.
Fun stuff. All right, well, let's finish off with, I know you've taught many classes before, do a little learning annex for our listening audience. What should all of our budding filmmakers know? Not everybody's dad owned a movie theater, so we didn't all get free popcorn, so I fear that not everyone is immersed in the background of film as you are. Where should people start out to get their ideas out there on film?
Well, you know, nowadays everybody can be a filmmaker. You've got the ability because it's in your hand. It's your, you know, your iPhone, your mobile phone. Well, you can do anything. And it's just get the experience, start making films. The one thing that I tell people is that if they want to genuinely get into this business, you know, people will come to me and say, hey, I'm going to give it 2 years, and if I haven't made it, then I'm going to go back to, you know, get a quote-unquote regular job. And my answer to that has always been, then don't bother. If this isn't in your blood, if you aren't going to dedicate from now till the day you die the idea that you're going to be a filmmaker or an actor or a screenwriter, whatever it is in this industry, if you're not determined to do that forever, no matter what the obstacles are, then you won't make it because there's too much competition out there. And you have to get used to a lot of rejection and a lot of no's to get that yes, to get that break. And you just got to dedicate yourself to that and you know, wait tables to make money to pay your bills or whatever it is. But your number one passion has got to be that thing that you want to do. I mean, that really goes for anything, but
yeah,
particularly in this crazy entertainment business.
I have to ask, in your Dante's Cove production meetings, what part did you come up with for the Cleveland radio host?
Well, let's see. There's this full frontal guy.
Great talking to you, Sam. It was great having you on here. I was even thinking Terry Ray and I, just like Blake Edwards had people do things in the background, we could be in the background doing something.
There you go.
All right. I love it. All right, listeners, this is what you need to do. You must go to Kickstarter.com. Just type in Dante's. We will provide the direct link for you. For all of you out there, and I say this time and time again, who have ever complained, oh, there's just not the content out there that we want to see. We live in an age right now where you guys get to directly contribute to having the content that you want to see get made. You have to stop complaining. You have to become a part of the process. And even better, that a project like this, again, Kickstarter.com, type in Dante's, you get perks for it too. You can be a part of the action. But even aside from the perks, though I know that does motivate people, please contribute knowing that you are contributing towards getting content made. Having lives, our LGBTQ lives on film, even in a fantasy way, it's great to see us represented in any way on the screen. So you guys get to be a part of that. Does that do it for them, Sam?
I could not have said it better. That's fantastic, Ken, and it's so true. But what's so exciting is they can really be a part of us making this show, and that's what I'm so excited about.
There it is. And as for you, sir, I've told you this before. You haven't been on in 2.5 years, so it's been a while. But I told you this 2.5 years ago. You really are putting the content out there that we want to see. I feel validated even just looking at the credits that you put out there. And I hope you know what a difference that makes for us to not go through our day and not see ourselves represented. You have us represented in your work. And that really is a huge deal, Sam. And I hope you know that and you bear our appreciation with you as you set forth.
Well, it's my pleasure, and it's what I enjoy to do. It's my pleasure to be on this show with you, and let's not make it so long in between now and the next one.
Deal. All right, folks, and we are back. Well, we have tons of time left on this week's episode. I feel like it has been forever and a day since we have hung out together on a new episode of This Show Is So Gay. Unfortunately, had to run a couple Rainbow Rewinds in the past couple weeks. There's just so much excitement happening here in Cleveland, Ohio, happening in my life. It is finals time of year, so yeah, that always tends to put a little bit of a damper on what I'm able to accomplish. But it was a really exciting semester. Three of my four courses this semester were focused on how we talk about race, how we talk about diversity, and I think we got to some real revelations. I think we got to some real sharing, and I think we got to some real role modeling that we actually can have these conversations and that society gets better. We forge more connections with each other. We treat each other more humanely. We stand up for others. We show up for others if we are able to have conversations. So that has been really exciting. And then on the personal front, as I briefly mentioned a few weeks ago, I sold my first book. I absolutely sold my first book. So you can learn all about it. It's called Seriously, What Am I Doing Here? The Adventures of a Wondering and Wandering Gay Jew. That's me. That's totally me. Seriously, What Am I Doing Here? The Adventures of a Wondering and Wandering Gay Jew. It's going to be available this spring 2017. It's being published by just an incredible imprint called 1984 Publishing. This spring 2017, you are going to be able to pick it up. And you can sign up to learn more about it. You just go to kenschneck.com. That's kenschneck.com/seriously. kenschneck.com/seriously. It would, of course, mean the world to me if you guys would go to kenschneck.com/seriously. And if you enter in your email address there, you are not obligated to do anything but receive an update when the book is ready for order. Seriously, What Am I Doing Here? The Adventures of a Wondering and Wandering Gay Jew. kenschneck.com/seriously. That's it. Let me get to all of the latest LGBTQ news that is out there right now. We haven't even talked about President-elect Trump all that much. There were protests. People are raising their voices in anger. There's such disappointment. There's such disarray. But the big question, at least for our show and for our community, is what kind of effect will a President Trump have on our LGBTQ equality? Well, it's starting to all come together, and it's not looking too great. I mean, what else did we expect? A lot of this outrage of thinking, well, my gosh, look what he's doing. Yeah, what did we think he was going to do? If you dial back to any of our past episodes when we talked about this election, this is what we were forecasting. This is what we thought was going to happen. So let's dive into it. Donald Trump has signaled that he plans to repeal federal protections for LGBT workers while in office. That is according to United States Representative Steve Russell. The Republican lawmaker was the man behind the Russell Amendment, which is a piece of legislation that would have allowed religious organizations an exemption from President Obama's 2014 executive order prohibiting companies with federal contracts from discriminating against employees due to their sexual orientation or gender identity. That amendment, which was attached to the National Defense Authorization Act, a defense spending bill — we just attach things to anything. If you look at, by the way, the heartbeat bill that just happened here in Ohio. I mean, there is just such horrible things happening and such infringements. But anyway, that amendment that was proposed by United States Representative Steve Russell was tabled last week. Well, Representative Russell told BuzzFeed this week that the Trump administration has offered him, quote, very positive signals that the White House will take the matter into its own hands. He said this, quote, these issues will be resolved and we've gotten some very good assurances moving forward. I am certainly encouraged by the signs that I am getting from the administration that is inbound. So Representative Russell claims that the issue with the Obama protections is that they offer little clarity, especially when it comes to faith-based organizations that work with the federal government. So instead of, you know, clarifying those, he's calling for those protections to not exist at all. LGBT civil rights organizations have warned that the Russell Amendment and other bills like it would have the effect on, of course, taking these rights away. Any organization that wishes to terminate LGBT workers, many have warned, could be safeguarded under a faith-based exemption. So, again, President-elect Trump signaling that, yes, he might take away some of the protections that have been afforded to our community under President Obama, under that administration. And then you have some of President-elect Trump's appointments that he is going to try to make. The latest one this week is Ben Carson. Ben Carson. Very anti-LGBT Ben Carson. So he has nominated, or he plans to nominate, Ben Carson as the Secretary for Housing and Urban Development. Carson is opposed to marriage equality. He also has argued that a sitting president should be able to ignore the Supreme Court when it comes to equal marriage rights. He has previously said this, quote, "We have to understand how the Constitution works. The president is required to carry out the laws of the land. The laws of the land come from the legislative branch. So if the legislative branch creates a law or changes a law, the executive branch has a responsibility to carry it out. It doesn't say they have the responsibility to carry out a judicial law." This is Dr. Ben Carson, who is displaying a staggering lack of understanding of how the Constitution actually works. Just to remind people, in case you're engaged in a conversation over this holiday season where someone says, "Oh yeah, that Dr. Ben Carson, he was right on with that." It is not the president's responsibility to enforce judicial law. Yeah, that's not actually what happened here. There's no such thing as this judicial law. This was the Supreme Court interpreting the laws of the land and finding them unconstitutional. And finding that, yes, we have more rights than we were previously being granted. So yeah, that's what the judicial branch does. That does not seem to be clear to Dr. Ben Carson. He has also previously described transgender people as abnormal. He once told a joke that same-sex couples shouldn't buy cakes from bakers who oppose marriage equality because they might put poison in their cake. He has said that the military should bring back Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And he has associated being LGBT with polygamy, pedophilia, and bestiality. When asked about non-discrimination legislation that provides protections for LGBT people, Dr. Ben Carson said this, quote, "I think everybody has equal rights, but I'm not sure that anybody should have extra rights when it comes to redefining everything for everybody else." That's, by the way, the old school argument, and he didn't say that long ago. That's the old school argument that my right to get married somehow devalues your marriage or redefines your marriage. It doesn't. Just focus on your own marriage, folks. You do not need to be worried about my marriage. You really should be focused on your own. Divorce rates were already skyrocketing before marriage equality was the law of the land. Please, please do not worry about my marriage. Worry about your own. So that's Dr. Ben Carson. Then let's talk about the inauguration. It seems that a Trump advisor has spoken too soon after claiming that Elton John would be singing at President-elect Donald Trump's inauguration on January 20th. Back in 2005, Donald Trump celebrated Sir Elton John's civil partnership with David Furnish. This was later converted into a marriage when same-sex marriage became legal in England and Wales. Well, transition team member Anthony Scaramucci told BBC Hard Talk that Trump would, quote, be the first American president in U.S. history that enters the White House with a pro-gay rights stance. He then went on to say this, quote, "Elton John is going to be doing our concert on the mall for the inauguration." That's what he said. That was a quote. "Elton John is going to be doing our concert on the mall for the inauguration." Well, a representative for Sir Elton John has said, quote, "Elton will not be performing at Trump's inauguration." That will not be happening. So, yeah, I don't know why you would just go out there and say that something like this is going to happen. Sir Elton John said this during the election cycle. He said, quote, "Hillary Clinton is, without a doubt, the only candidate supremely qualified to lead this great nation in these challenging times." There really wasn't much of a chance that he was going to play at the inauguration. Please, folks, check your bookings before you announce them to the world. It's really helpful. It can save you potentially from some embarrassing stories, like the one that was covered this week about how you said that Elton John was going to perform at your inauguration, and that's not true at all. Hey, our South Carolina update of the week, because it's been a while since we've done this, lagging by about 10,000 votes in the gubernatorial election, North Carolina's infamous governor, Pat McCrory, has finally conceded. He is paving the way for an LGBT-friendly governor to assume office. Attorney General Roy Cooper will be North Carolina's next governor. He's a Democrat, and he's a staunch opponent of HB2, House Bill 2, the intensely homophobic, transphobic bill signed into law by McCrory this year. HB2, not that you need a reminder, but I'm doing it anyway. HB2 rescinded all LGBT-inclusive non-discrimination protections in the state. It banned future protections, and it mandated what public restrooms transgender North Carolinians could use when they're in government buildings. Again, people think, oh, it's just about restrooms. It's really not. HB2 rescinded all LGBT-inclusive non-discrimination protections in the state, and it banned any future protections. The state has lost billions of dollars. Not hundreds of dollars. Not thousands. Not tens or hundreds of thousands. Not millions. Billions. The state has lost billions of dollars in revenue following boycotts and intense outcry over HB2, and it's believed the legislation contributed to McCrory's loss. In fact, by the way, they have done polls since then of North Carolinians, and people have said, yes, this absolutely contributed to my not voting for Pat McCrory. After challenging the election results for weeks, McCrory finally conceded in a video released this week in which he claims North Carolina is in a better position because of his leadership. Human Rights Campaign President Chad Griffin said this in a statement, quote, Pat McCrory's reign of discrimination is finally over. McCrory's stubborn and reckless support of HB2 cost him this election, and his defeat sends a powerful warning to lawmakers across the country that targeting LGBT people will not be tolerated. We look forward to working with Governor-elect Roy Cooper and fair-minded lawmakers to repeal HB2. It's way past time to repair the harm inflicted on North Carolina's people, reputation, and economy. Again, that's Human Rights Campaign President Chad Griffin. There seems to be some consolation, though, for former Governor Pat McCrory. He immediately then met with Donald Trump. So there might be a position in the cabinet there for Pat McCrory. He might find himself an appointment. And there's a lot of speculation out there. Did he concede because President-elect Trump has promised him something else? We will surely find out. We will surely find out. Some other news that's out there, the Anti-Gay American Family Association, our buddies, the American Family Association, they might be booted out of a charity scheme in Connecticut because they have likened homosexuality to pedophilia and they've waged a war against gay people. One of the largest anti-LGBT organizations in this United States of America, the American Family Association maintains tax-exempt charitable status, meaning taxpayers effectively subsidize their frequent anti-LGBT boycotts and homophobic witch hunts. However, the group may be dropped from a state charity scheme in Connecticut after concerns were flagged about policies. The state of Connecticut's comptroller office wrote to the American Family Association this week in relation to Connecticut State Employees' Campaign for Charitable Giving, which allows state employees to donate to charities through a payroll deduction. Well, the letter warned this, quote, all organizations must submit an anti-discrimination certificate. I mean, this is funny. You basically just told the American Family Association that they need to submit an anti-discrimination certificate each year as a condition of participating in this Connecticut State Employee Campaign for Charitable Giving. However, despite certifying your compliance, there are several indications that the American Family Association may be violating these anti-discrimination prohibitions. You think, folks? You think the American Family Association might be violating those prohibitions? Yeah, I think so. The letter went on to say this, quote, the American Family Association, on its website, claims that it seeks to hold companies accountable that attack traditional family values. However, a review of the American Family Association's statements indicate that its so-called attempts to protect family values involve combating the homosexual agenda by boycotting companies that promote equal treatment, tolerance, and acceptance of all families and marriages. The AFA's efforts have included a nationwide petition to boycott Target for the company's inclusive transgender restroom policy and denouncing Zales for normalizing sin by advertising wedding bands to same-sex couples. And the letter goes on and on. I just think it's hilarious that the AFA, the American Family Association, submitted a certificate that asserted that they don't discriminate. They are perhaps the most anti-gay organization in this country, and they're saying they don't discriminate. Not so. Not so. Turning our attention to Orlando, the Pulse nightclub will not be taken into public ownership as the club's owner has backed out of plans to turn the site into a publicly run memorial. The gay nightclub was, of course, the scene of a horrific event back in June when 49 people were murdered and 53 people injured. It was the largest mass shooting in United States history. The victims were disproportionately LGBT and of Latino or Hispanic heritage. After the cleanup of the scene concluded, a question mark remained over whether the club would reopen or be converted into a more permanent memorial to the victims. Orlando Mayor Buddy Dyer had led a campaign for the city of Orlando to take ownership of the site, making a formal bid to buy the club from its private owners. However, the deal fell through this week when owner Barbara Poma backed out of this deal. Ms. Poma, who originally opened the club in memory of her late brother, said she was unable to part with the property. She told local press that she does not know yet whether she will keep the existing club building standing, but she has pledged to create a permanent memorial at the existing site of Pulse Nightclub. So there you go. We do not know what she's going to do, and honestly, we can't fault her. Whatever she wants to do with that property, that's her right to do it. It was devastating for her. I've read a ton of interviews with her. I can't even wrap my mind around what this must have been like for her, for Barbara Poma, who owns this property. So we will see what happens. It sounds like there will be some sort of memorial on this site, but we don't know. We don't know what that's going to look like. Maybe Pulse Nightclub will reopen. Don't know. Totally her decision, and we support whatever her decision may be. Let's see what it is, though, first. And that, my friends, is it for this week's episode. That's all the time we have left. Our thanks, of course, to Sam Ervin, all the great things he's doing. He has put such incredible content out there. Go support Dante's Cove. Bring it back on the air. Just go to Kickstarter.com and type in Dante's, and that will pull right up for you. So happy to be back with you guys. We have tons of new episodes coming at you all throughout the holiday season, so no more Rainbow Rewinds for a while. I promise you that. An exciting show for you next week. You're going to have to tune in to find out what it is. In the meantime, get out there. Go use your voice the way you know how to use it to make a difference for your LGBTQ and ally brothers and sisters out there. And while you're out there making a difference, while you're out there using your voice, please, please remember, why be gay when you can be so gay?
Everybody got pain, aching in their heart. They got pain, aching in their heart. So don't hold back. Trouble in their heart. Don't hold back. Whisper in my ear. Share it with a neighbor. Watch it disappear. The truth shall set you free.